Welcome, welcome, welcome. It's another episode of Old Bones, and we've got a doozy for you today. We're going to head far to the north of England, to Hadrian's Wall. We'll turn left at the coast near Newcastle and climb up into the Northumbrian Hills, where the world gets craggy and marshy in equal turn. A land that is so compellingly difficult that it was a land of brigands for much of the Middle Ages. Up there amongst the windswept hills and purple heather is the fort of Burd Oswald. For the second episode in a row, the burial upon which our story hangs is fully embracing the jumping-off point aesthetic of the podcast. I don't want to diminish the remains of any human, but really, the discovery we'll talk about in a second is but the flexing in the hamstrings, the pushing into the ground before leaping into narratives which may be audibly long, but are historically short. Our burial today comes from the early 500s. It was found during standard excavations by standard archaeologists. No, exciting discovery stories today. The skeleton itself is about as ordinary as one may expect from a skeleton, but the location of the burial is interesting. Unsurprisingly, the burial is found at Burd Oswald, 100 years after the Romans had left the site in the early 400s. Since then, the fort and its environs had shifted from being a site of Roman military organisation encapsulated in stone and tile into a much more typically Germanic centre built around wood and turf. Burd Oswald in the 400s and early 500s was a site peppered with a string of ever grander halls. Our friend is buried in the entrance to one of those large, aisled halls, kind you see on Last Kingdom or Vikings. The person was buried there at the end of the hall's life. The end of this person's life, the life of the hall, and the life of our site all coincided. After this burial, people abandoned Burd Oswald. Now, doesn't that sound exciting? It does, and maybe we will revisit Burd Oswald when we talk about the nature of Anglo-Saxon sites, because here's the thing, abandonment, shifting, is a bit of a feature of the Germanic culture that takes hold in England. Burd Oswald is similar and seems to have become a relatively standard Anglo-Saxon settlement, with the people of Burd Oswald shifting from a Roman style of fort and vicus to a site punctuated with either those large halls or small, slunken floor buildings which probably had multiple uses like storage or manufacturing. The end of Burd Oswald is fascinating stuff, but not for today. I want to understand how we got from Romano-British to Anglo-Saxon in less than a generation. Last week, we ended the story in 410 when the Romans left. This fort continued for another century or so. Why? What happened during this time? Well, that opens up the can of worms called civilizational collapse. Now, at the moment, I spend my life talking about theory, which I love, but soon-to-be Mrs. Bones assures me that, for some reason, not everyone loves obscure French post-structuralists or the final points of Husserlian phenomenology as much as I do. So, what I'm going to do instead is try and attempt what I claim to be learning so much theory for. We're going to hide the theory in three brief stories and propose reasons why Burd Oswald changed from being a Roman site to one which is just about Anglo-Saxon. This will look at the same single day from three different potential histories to show how the shift we've seen in the evidence might have started happening. I am conflating what is potentially decades of change into a single day, but I think that helps fix the ideas in my mind and maybe your mind too. To be deliberately provocative, each story is going to follow a young man called Arthur. Oh, and if you feel the itch to overthrow the bourgeoisie at the end while screaming your love for Lenin, don't worry, it's not you. It's just that one of the stories comes from neo-Marxist archaeology. Let's dive into the three stories of Burd Oswald. I'm Andy Earnshaw, and welcome to Old Bones. Apparently the Romans had left. That's what Arthur heard as he walked through the vicus, trying to avoid doing anything like work at his father's tannery. He heard one of the pretty women, who knew all the soldiers, saying that their mother had heard from a friend that their cousin had been at one of the villas down south, one of the big ones with heated floors like the commander's house. They'd received a letter from some guy saying the local city had been told by Londinium that the emperor had refused to return the soldiers who'd left to defend Gaul. What do you think's going to happen? Arthur dropped down an alleyway as he heard a shoemaker his father knew speak to a man in, well, it wasn't uniform he was wearing, but it was definitely armour, and he had a sword. That was uniform enough for Arthur, but he wanted to listen, and so he hid. A cat slid between his legs and purred. Arthur rubbed the top of its head while doing his best to drop some eaves. Boss says nothing changes. The man in, well, let's call it uniform, had the gruff voice of a man used to telling people quite firmly what they couldn't do. But who will be in charge? Asked the shoemaker. Arthur could almost hear the shrug from the man in uniform. As I said, boss says nothing changes. Everyone's to keep working, keep paying taxes.
Whoa. We're still paying taxes? What for?
So you can keep standing on the street speaking like a stupid person. That's what. We're friends, right?
Of course.
Arthur had to strain to hear the low, gravelly voice of the uniformed man. Then don't change anything. Boss wants everything to go smooth, and those who keep things smooth will be well received, if you know what I mean.
Fair enough.
Thanks, said the shoekeeper. See you later. And be sensible.
Yeah, replied the shoemaker. Thanks.
Arthur decided it wasn't wise to appear near the shoemaker just yet. He edged his way down the alleyway, climbed over a fence into another alleyway and back onto the main street, the one that led up to the fort. There was a mood in the air. People were bustling about as usual, and on the surface, the main road seemed as busy as ever. But on doorsteps and outside of shops, groups of twos or threes were muttering to each other. Arthur heard many things as he walked down the main road of the Vicus. Can't believe the commander's decided he's boss now.
Still making us pay our taxes? For what? The Picts could be here any day. Then what will he do with 40 men?
Who knows, the Romans aren't going to come back.
Has he thought of that? What will they do to him when they find he's taken over their land?
A knot began to form in Arthur's stomach, the very certain feeling that something was wrong and he didn't understand what was happening. He kept walking, kept hearing the disquiet grow all around him, until without realising, he was at the gates of the old fort. The entrance was guarded by two men, big chaps, fully armoured with heavy spears in hands and swords by their sides.
What are you looking at, boy? One of the big men with a big shield growled at him.
Nothing, replied Arthur.
Then get lost.
He stared at Arthur. Arthur stared back, then shrugged. He turned round and began walking home. When he opened the door, his mother wrapped him in a hug. She looked close to tears.
You stay home for the next few days, son. Things are going to be very strange for a little while, his dad said from the far doorway where he was working.
Arthur nodded, walked through the house to the back door. He crossed the yard to the tannery. In there it was quiet. Work was winding down for the day. Arthur began to roll the finished leather, tying it together with a cord and stacking it into boxes. It wasn't a bad place to hide for a little while, at least until things returned to normal. Arthur's mother was calling him. He didn't want to leave. It was a sunny day and his feet were hanging off of the cliff. He was so high, he was above the treetops, and he felt like a hawk, able to see lakes in a way you couldn't elsewhere. The world felt impossibly large with your feet hanging over the edge of the cliff. It was a free world, unfettered by orders and instruction. But his mother was calling him, and he knew it was important. She only left the house for things that were vitally important. Arthur trudged towards her.
Come, she said to him as he reached her.
She grabbed his arm, even though he was taller than her now, and dragged him away.
We're needed at the fort.
The fort? Why? Asked Arthur. They never went to the fort. Apparently everyone needs to meet on the parade ground. The commander wants to speak with us. Arthur felt excited, but nervous. The officers rarely spoke with the locals. Well, not in any official capacity. It was new, and new things were good, right? Something to make the days pass. But the way his mother spoke, the sense of urgency, uncertainty, suggested to him that maybe he shouldn't be all that excited. They joined a mass of people moving up the Vicus's main road. Guards stood at the entrance to the fort,
watching people enter and confiscating any weapons larger than a knife. They stood in the centre of the fort. The buildings were still standing, but many were missing tiles from their roofs. Others had patches filled in with turf or thatch. Stones were missing from the road and had been filled in with dirt. Arthur spotted cobblestones in the walls, patching up areas that had slumped down. He'd not seen supplies arrive at the fort in a long time, and he'd heard on the streets that the stone buildings were ill-suited to the harsh rain and cold of Burd Oswald. All of the settlement was crammed onto the parade ground. There had always been more of them than the soldiers. Soldiers eat a lot of food and wear through a lot of clothes. Now, though, most of the soldiers stood in front of the commander's house, surrounding a small box which looked out onto the gathering. The commander climbed onto the box, his back to the commander's house. He raised his hands, and over the course of a few very long seconds, the hubbub declined and silence grew. In the north, the Picts prepare to raid. In the west, the Scots and the Irish prepare to raid. From the east, the Saxons land. Until we have looked to the south and received nothing. Our lands are not as rich as they once were, our populations not so large. Since the Great Plague, here in the far north of civilization, we have struggled on and on and on to remain part of the empire. But it is time we forge our own path. It is time we look to ourselves, to our neighbours, and not some fancy men in Eboracum or Londinium. There were murmurs of approval. Rates had increased. Posts came from the south less often, and everyone did feel a little on their own. Arthur's mum squeezed his hand tightly. He couldn't tell from nerves or excitement. "I have been speaking with many of the soldiers," continued the commander, "and also some of those friends who have been with us since the Great Conspiracy." At this, he gestured to the large Saxons in front of him, their arms thick with gold rings, heavy axes on their hips. They stood to the side, arms crossed, stares thunderous. "It is time for us to look to our own defences, our own abilities. We're almost untouchable up here, with crops and sheep and trees aplenty. We have weapons. There is no reason we cannot dominate as the Romans did. If you pay less to me than you ever did to Eboracum, then myself, my soldiers and our Saxon friends will see off the raids and bring you all wealth and presents beyond anything the Romans ever gave you. What do you say?" The commander paused and looked around. The crowd was quiet. They understood what was being said and weren't necessarily unhappy about it, but were definitely happier to stay quiet and keep their heads. Arthur squeezed his mother's hand. They glanced at each other and started to edge towards the exit. They didn't want to be the first out. That might draw attention, but they definitely didn't want to be here when any debate started. "These are big changes, I know, but we could have a new and glorious future. Yes, my friend, what do you want to say?" The commander gestured to someone in the crowd who had raised their hand. "I think, sir, that we're all a bit nervous. The Romans cost us all a lot, but they weren't ever very violent, not to us common folk. It's a lot of weapons you've got and a lot of control you want. We just want to be safe." The captain smiled a big, toothy grin. Arthur didn't love how it made him feel, both safe and scared at the same time. "It's a fair question, but I ask you, what would we do? You are our friends, our family. You keep us fed, warm, and armed. We in turn will keep you safe and bring you gifts, all one system, working together to survive what I think we are all sure will be a tumultuous time. Does anybody wish to propose another solution?" The Saxon men rolled their necks. The captain looked out and smiled that big, toothy grin again. "Very good. Thank you for your time," said the commander. "I will see you all very, very soon. Farewell." The argument was explosive. People were shouting at each other, using words Arthur had never heard before. They were very guttural. He liked how they sounded, but was otherwise struggling to work out what they were saying. His mother was next to him and she looked concerned and flustered. Everyone was crammed into a hall they'd built by the edge of the fort. No one wanted to enter the fort anymore. The stone walls were tumbling and tiles sometimes crashed to the ground. Instead, they built a big gathering hall to celebrate Yuletide and other festivals. Right now, it was loud and hot and smoky from the fire in the centre. The oppressive atmosphere wasn't helped by the, well, Arthur had heard it called a discussion, which seemed to sound much politer than what was actually happening. "The crops aren't growing as well as they should," shouted one man. "We can't be sending a fifth of what we grow to Eboricum. We can barely survive." "The sheep are starved," shouted another. Raiders have been spotted," a woman cried. "We need to write to Eboricum. Tell them to help us." "Oh, get out of here. They won't listen. They've barely sent us a stone in months." "What are those at Vindolanda? Surely they're still with us." "They are," responded someone less shoutily, "but they're in the same boat, isolated and alone, with Picts and Saxons surrounding them." "May I make a proposal?" spoke a woman, quietly. She looked nervous and she squinted through the smoke a lot. The people in the hall shrugged. No one else was making much progress. "It feels to me that our friends along the wall are still just that. What if we were to stop sending tribute to Eboricum, but to send surplus to our friends along the wall? Gifts, as it were. To remind them that we're there for them, that we exist, and that we should be, and that they should be there for us." "Well, that's stone and tile from Eboricum. We won't get those if we don't pay tribute. We've not had any for 2 years, and look at the state of our halls. Our forests are still dense, our food enough for us all. Let's look to ourselves. We have weapons enough in the fort, and we can make spears and bows from what we have around us." The crowd was quiet. Arthur could almost hear them chewing over the proposal like a sheep chews on cud. "Who'll be in charge?" asked one man, who had previously said some of the guttural words Arthur didn't understand, but now spoke politely, almost nervously. "Why do we need someone to be in charge? This hall is big enough for all of us. It's not like we're going to war or doing anything complex. When buildings need to be made, we'll gather and decide, together. When sewers need to be dug, we'll all pitch in. When people attack us, we don't need a debate. We'll all grab weapons and defend ourselves. We can take it in turns to keep a lookout, turns to watch the sheep. Those who have the skills can continue using those skills, but also helping out, as they won't have so much to do if we're not sending things to Eboricum. I remember my father speaking with a Saxon man a few years ago. The Saxons meet once a month at a thing or a moot or something like that. There they talk, decide together on punishments for the bad things people have done, agree on where to invest their resources and settle any disputes. We could do as the Saxons do." There were mutterings of approval. "All right, but who'd make sure the meetings go ahead?" asked another person. What about our five eldest? The one we all agree are the wisest. They'll host the meetings. They'll know our laws and our ways best, and we'll meet every evening of the full moon in the largest hall, so everyone can be safe and know when to meet." Arthur looked up at his mother. She looked calmer. She looked happy for the first time in days. He looked up at the woman. She seemed more confident, to have grown a few inches. The room felt excited, like they could achieve something. "All in favour," shouted one of the men. Cheers erupted. People started slapping each other on the back and grinning up at the woman. "Shall we meet here? Next full moon?" she asked. A resounding yes crashed back at her. The shy woman with the squint who'd saved them all allowed herself a very small smile. Each of these three stories gives a different insight into how people respond to quote-unquote social collapse. Social collapse is a topic that is far bigger than we're going to manage to scratch at today. The period too is one which is far fuzzier and far more hotly contested than we've dared approach in our three stories. I could have talked you through the period from the fall of the Romans to when Abero was left in the early 500s. Let me reiterate why I didn't. The early part of the season doesn't have sites like Cheddar Gorge or Orkney like we had in our first series. These are sites that have been well studied, are relatively simple, and have a long history of scholarship associated with them. Until people like Catherine Hill start taking this period seriously in the 1960s and 70s, most folk just assume things got a bit peasanty until Bede started writing. We've got some great sites to speak about, but with a much shorter period and a higher degree of historical resolution, we can't stamp as confidently through the archaeological record. We need to be more cautious, more theory-led, and trying to expose the debates to bring out possible stories. You're an active part of this. You need to be the ones to decide which stories that I tell make the most sense to you. And then you need to tell me about that so that I can improve what we're all listening to. And let me add some other qualifications while we're here. They aren't to reduce the power of what I've just said. No, they're to arm you with the necessary context to come to your own conclusions. One, in all of our stories, especially the last two, there is a definite sense of people deciding to move on, to make a break with the past. This is a massive assumption on my part. People did have complex, interesting relationships with their own past. Not in the same way as we do, but in a way that is definitely comparable. We know from our debates this leads to three broad schools of thought. Either that we need to preserve tradition, completely rip up an outdated playbook, or that we need to respect the spirit of traditions, but progress at a steady pace. Unsurprisingly, this fits within our political environments, where we have a very noisy left and right with a softer, more cautious middle ground. All the stories I've written fall more into the latter two camps, which might betray my political positions, but I think is backed up by the evidence. The material culture shifts, but one can make the argument that people tried to maintain the culture but lacked the connections and technology to do so, and thus adapted. Not sure I like to be the one trying to defend that argument, but it is definitely possible. Two, the second assumption is that the culture which emerges in the early 400s was definitely different to that of the mid-300s. Last week we noted that this cultural shift started well before the Romans officially left. But I've not even suggested that might not be the case this episode, and there are many scholars who still see the Romans leaving as a tragic, decisive moment that happened around 410 CE. All of which to say, let me know what you think of today's episode. Episodes at the end of last season and the start of this season were tending towards being longer and more comprehensive. Those sort of episodes will not be possible for a little while. Not if I'm to mentally survive. Terms at Oxford are intense. Exhilarating, but intense. And I won't have much time until the summer for episodes that are much longer or more comprehensive than today's. Instead, as we've done today, we're going to get more creative, tell more stories, but always back them up with top-notch research. I want to hear what you think. You can find me on Facebook, Instagram. Of course, I'd love you to join me on Patreon when I finally succumbed and re-downloaded Twitter. I've added my Twitter handle to the show notes. In terms of going forward, in terms of what is coming up, I've got some special things planned for this year's Christmas episode. Well, if lockdown allows us to do them. And then in the new year, at the end of January, we're going to the opposite end of England from Bird Oswald. We're going to soon to be Mrs. Bone's happy place. We're off to Cornwall, to the birthplace of King Arthur. We're going to Tintagel. There we will explore a world that was forever on the edge of Romanitas and kept a strange, distorted version of the flag of Romanitas flying well into the 500s. I hope all of you are doing well, and I hope I brought you all some joy this month. Stay warm and stay safe. I'm Andy Urchaw, and this is All Bones. See you soon.